Ave podcast listeners, be warned beforehand, this episode of Emperors of Rome describes self-harm and suicide, and in this instance explores sources that glorify it. If this impacts on your mental health, please be aware and take care of yourself. Enjoy the episode. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CCXLVIII, Pietas It Does Not Hurt. Aria and her daughter of the same name were celebrated in Roman literature for their virtues, piety, and devotion to family. Remembered above all for their willingness to embrace self-sacrifice, their lives and deaths became exemplars of courage and duty, cited by writers like Pliny and Martial as models of Roman virtue. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Today we're discussing two women from the same family, actually three by extension, who illustrate the idea of self-sacrifice, actually giving up one's life for one's husband and for the ideals that they stand for, and dying alongside one's husband. So men who are told that they have to kill themselves because they have displeased the emperor, whose wives, well, in one case, actually lead by example when the husband is hesitating. So it's a difficult subject because it's about embracing suicide. We always have to remember, we've discussed before, that there's a very different attitude to suicide in antiquity and for the Romans. It is a kind of elite form of execution that you are allowed to take charge of your own death rather than it being forced upon you by crucifixion or some other shameful way. So this is considered something that is, actually a positive in a terrible situation. Or if you cannot bear to, say, someone like Cato the Younger can't bear to live under the regime of Julius Caesar, then this is a way of taking control of that, of not having to put up with that, having to tolerate a terrible regime.
So in all of these circumstances, it's held up as good virtues for a Roman woman to have a good behavior.
It's good behavior for any Roman, and I guess unexpected for a woman to be that brave as well. Because what this exemplifies for an elite Roman, and it's very much to the perspective of our text, is virtus, that kind of fortitude, strength, bravery, which has the word vir in it, which means man, which means virile. So it's a woman exhibiting the kind of qualities you expect in a male Roman citizen. But that's all to the good in these circumstances, that they go alongside, that they try to accompany their husband into this very brave and dignified death.
Okay, so tell me about these women and I guess by extension, tell us initially about the most important thing where we know about them from and take it back to a man, please.
Yes, don't get too far into this. All right, none of these women have left their own account of this. Yeah. The main account we have comes from the letters of Pliny the Younger, who is, in case you haven't encountered him before, he's writing in the late 1st century CE. He's a very elite Roman. He's a nephew of Pliny the Elder, famous for dying at Vesuvius. We know about that because Pliny the Younger records it. He rises up the political ranks and he writes 10 books of letters, and book 10 is a series of letters to the Emperor Trajan when Pliny is governor in Bithynia. So he's got all of the, he's networked into the Roman elite. He's very much part of literary culture. He's one of those people who claims to have despised the Emperor Domitian after Domitian is murdered in 96. So he reflects back on him, how the current situation is better. And in these letters, he's reflecting back on other tyrannical emperors, because these are the scenarios in which our two women live. They're living under Claudius and Nero, and their husbands are asked to kill themselves, told to kill themselves by those emperors. So that's Pliny. The women he is writing about, confusingly, are both called Aria, a mother and a daughter, which is interesting in itself, and we might come back to the names, the fact that they're both called Aria. We tend to refer to them as Aria the Elder and Aria the Younger. Yeah. That's a kind of modern way of disambiguating them. And yes, we've got a little more information about Arria the Elder.
All right. If we take these one at a time, which I assume Pliny did in his letters, what do we know about Arria the Elder and what context is she being discussed in?
So she is married to a man called Aulus Caecinia Paetus, and very important that his name is Paetus, bear that in mind. They have at least two children, and this comes from Pliny's letter, Book 3, Letter 16. There is a son who dies as a child, and that son's death is going to be important in part of this narrative. There is a daughter called Arria who lives to adulthood, and there might be another son too. That's speculated by a scholar called Joanne Shelton, who tries to work out the chronology all of this, but it's all kind of speculative, you know, exactly when Arria was born. We do know that Arria the Elder accompanied her husband Paetus to Dalmatia around 40 CE. So if you think about what's happening around then, Caligula is emperor. He is still in Dalmatia when he hears, when they all hear about Caligula's death. Caligula's murdered in 41. And Paetus joins a senatorial plot to overthrow the whole idea of emperorship, but effectively to overthrow Claudius, the next emperor, and to restore the Republic.
Okay.
This is often considered one of the last times that there was the potential for the restoration of the Republic.
Yeah.
Right? If they'd acted fast enough.
Essentially, people, you know, aren't remembering the Republic very much at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
If at all.
Yeah. And, you know, it's often thought that if Claudius hadn't been found by chance in the palace, if they had acted faster than the Praetorian Guard, then
there's
maybe they'd have got
ifs.
It.
There's a lot of ifs there.
A lot of ifs. You're quite right. So this rebellion, the reason that it's important that Paetus and Arria are in Dalmatia is that the rebellion is led by the governor of Dalmatia, a man called Camillus Scribonianus.
Mm-hmm.
In the following year, because he's proconsul, because he's governor in Dalmatia, he's got an army with him and he tries to get them to turn on Claudius, but they don't. So that's a big failure. He hasn't got an army behind him. And that means also that the story's going to get out. He tries to escape. He tries to flee, but he dies. We don't know whether he's executed or kills himself. Paetus is taken back to Rome to be put on trial.
Okay.
Paetus is charged with conspiracy. He is found guilty. He's ordered to self-execute, all right, to die by suicide.
So he's given a good way out.
Yeah,
in Roman terms, yes.
In Roman terms, absolutely, for an elite man. The story is that when he comes to kill himself, Paetus hesitates. He's got a sword. He's not drawing it. Arria is there and she is the brave one. And this is what Pliny says in letter 316, which, by the way, is dated to considerably later, sometime between 97 and 107 CE. Pliny says, "It was indeed a splendid deed of hers, of Arria's, to draw the sword from its sheath, to plunge it into her breast, then to pull it out and offer it to her husband with the words which will live forever and seem to have been more than mortal. Paetus, it does not hurt."
So she's embarrassing him, but... No. Oh, sorry, I can't believe I said that first.
Yeah. Well, you're right.
Yeah.
She is being braver than him.
Yeah.
Like, you've got to do it. And he then subsequently does.
Yes.
Then he doesn't. I don't think he actually says that, but that's the implication, and we know that he dies.
Mm.
So yes, she is being more manly than a man.
Mm.
And she doesn't have to kill herself. She's not convicted, but she does it anyway, presumably to be with him, to share in his death, and also to show him the way.
Yes.
And it becomes a very famous phrase. In Latin, it's even briefer, as Latin often is. She just says, "Paete, non dolet." It doesn't hurt.
Mm-hmm.
No, it doesn't cause you suffering.
Okay, so this is Pliny writing about something that happened 60 years earlier. So it's famous in his time.
Absolutely.
That this happened. The context is that he knows the family, and this sounds like a story that they have about Arria the Elder and the good virtues that she has as a Roman woman. And it's famous in its own time.
It absolutely is. So Pliny knows the family. He's writing about various anecdotes to do with Arria. He particularly knows the granddaughter. But an earlier poem written in the 80s, about 86, by Marshall, has already celebrated Aria. I think she is just famous for this.
Mm.
And this is typically, for Marshall, very pithy. And of course, what Aria says is very pithy as well. So in a four-liner, Marshall says, this is book one, poem 13, "When the chaste Aria handed to Pytus the sword, which she had with her own hand drawn forth from her heart. 'If you believe me,' said she, 'the wound which I have gives me no pain, but it is that which you make, Pytus, that pains me.'" That's so, considerably longer than what
I was about to say.
"Paite non dolet."
I know Marshall as well for brevity.
Yeah, the translation isn't doing any favors here. I should have retranslated it. This is an older translation. Yeah, she says, "The wound which I've made doesn't hurt, but the one which you will make, Pytus, that pains me, that mm-hmm. hurts me."
Yes.
All right, so it's your death that's going to pain me, although yeah. I've already just killed myself.
And it's the double meaning of Marshall.
Yes. Yeah. Also, by the way, this translation obscures a bit of the, it's a bit more edgy in Marshall. There's a yuck factor. He doesn't say draw form from her heart. He says from her viscera, from her,
yeah.
her innards.
Okay.
And that's the polite way of putting it.
Mm.
So Marshall adds some words to it. Did she say all of those? I mean, she's got a sword in her chest. I think saying "paite non dolet" is quite an accomplishment.
Yeah.
So I think he poeticizes it. He celebrates her even more. He makes her even more of a worthy wife. Not only is she showing him the way, killing herself when she doesn't need to, but also she's saying, "Your death is the thing that hurts me."
Mm.
So that's how much affection she feels for him. The implication is that not only is she braver than him and needs to show him how to do this, but she doesn't want to live beyond his life anyway.
Yeah.
So there's that kind of double nature of being very brave, but also so dedicated to her husband that she will die because he's dying.
So while these are good qualities for a Roman woman to have, what is the context of Pliny bringing this up at this point?
I'd question whether they're really good qualities, but from Pliny's point of view and Marshall's, they definitely
are. Yes, yes.
Yes. Okay, so Pliny's actually paradoxically saying that's not the thing she should be most famous for.
Mm.
And he's kind of burnishing his own acquaintance with the family. He says, "Oh, the other day I was talking to Fannia, who's the granddaughter of Aria the Elder." And he's saying, you know, the things that people are most famous for are often not the things they should be most renowned for. We should be quoting other great things they did. It's not just what they do in death, but what they did in life. And then he goes on to discuss other venerable, worthy actions of Aria. And his conclusion is, you can see how this kind of dignity and bravery and greatness in life was leading up to what the way that she carried out her death. It didn't just come from nowhere. This is the way she lived her life.
Mm.
So that's kind of his point in this letter, which is addressed to a friend called Nepos. And he gets these stories from Fannia. So as I say, I'm friends with that famous family.
Yes.
But I know the people who rebelled against bad tyrannical emperors. And he goes on, he should be even as well known as the "Pytus, it does not hurt" line. Is the story of when their son died. It's a very sad story.
Mm.
And what Aria did, how she bore herself during that period. I'm going to read directly from the letter here because I don't think I can say it better. "When the son dies, Pytus is also ill. So Pliny says, her husband, Caecina Pytus, was lying ill, and so too was their son. Both, it was thought, without chance of recovery. The son died. He was a strikingly handsome lad, modest as he was handsome, and endeared to his parents for his other virtues quite as much as because he was their son." Young people are always fantastic in Pliny.
That was a very circular statement as well.
Aria made all the arrangements for the funeral, a woman having to be active here again, and attended it in person without her husband knowing anything of it.
Yeah.
So the virtue here is hiding it from her husband. He doesn't know that the boy has died, let alone that a funeral has taken place.
So she's not allowing herself time to mourn.
No.
Because she's got to take charge here.
Yes.
And she's got to protect her husband,
who is mortally ill.
Yes.
And she doesn't want this information to affect him if he's got any chance of recovery.
Mm.
"When she entered his room, she pretended the boy was still alive and even much better. And when her husband constantly asked how the lad was getting on, she replied, 'He has had a good sleep and has taken food with good appetite.' Then, when the tears, which she had long forced back, overcame her and burst their way out, she would leave the room, and not till then give grief its course, returning when the flood of tears was over, with dry eyes and composed look, as though she had left her bereavement at the door of the chamber. So this is about self-control, absolutely, as is the story of her death, I guess, to a degree, that she can, I mean, she's lying to her husband, she's concealing the truth, apparently for his benefit, but that she can kind of decide when she's going to show her grief, and then she can cover it all up completely the rest of the time. Now, the kind of received wisdom on this family is that they're part of the so-called Stoic resistance to various emperors.
Yeah.
It comes from this kind of information. We don't know for sure. There do seem to be some alignments with Stoic figures, but it's never outrightly stated that Pytus or Arria or someone in the family is a practicing Stoic.
Okay.
But we think of Stoicism, it is a lot more than this, but we're not wrong to think of Stoics as making it really important that you can keep control of your emotions, not give way, not be reactive, all right? To act in a way that shows that you have, that you're not overcome by emotion.
Yeah.
It's something that you have some kind of power over. So it's not overpowering you. These days, we think of Stoicism as meaning you're completely divorced from your emotions, and it's not that. Pliny has other anecdotes about Arria. For example, he refers to the point of the rebellion when the governor of Dalmatia, Scribonianus, was starting to raise the rebellion. He says, when Scribonianus had started a rebellion in Illyricum against Claudius, Pytus joined his party, so Arria's husband joins. And on the death of Scribonianus, this is how we know he dies, we don't know how, he, that is Pytus, was brought as a prisoner to Rome. As he was about to embark, Arria implored the soldiers to take her on board with him. For, she pleaded, as he is of consular rank, so he's important, you will assign him some servants to serve his meals, to valet him, this is an old translation, and put on his shoes. So it's going to be enslaved people to attend him. I will perform all these offices for him. When they refused her, she hired a fishing boat and in that tiny vessel followed the big ship. So this is kind of outstanding and surprising, I think, to a Roman reader, because she is offering to act the part of an enslaved person. Again, that's how dedicated she is to her husband.
Yeah.
And the cruelty of the soldiers who don't let her even do that, let her demean herself for her husband, that she makes sure she is close by, hires this little boat, and which would, you know, be quite dangerous, crossing from Dalmatia, Croatia, over to Italy.
Yeah.
Nothing safe on the seas, according to the Romans.
In a little fishing boat. Yeah.
Again, Pliny continues, in the presence of Claudius, she said to the wife of Scribonianus, so remember the governor of Dalmatia, who's now dead, when that woman was voluntarily giving evidence of the rebellion, what, shall I listen to you in whose bosom Scribonianus was killed, and yet you still live? These words showed that her resolve to die gloriously was due to no sudden impulse. Oh my God, she sounds humorless. This woman has lost her husband. She's probably trying to save herself and her family by giving evidence.
Yeah, but, you know, how dare she try and save herself?
Harry is so high and mighty, isn't he? Cards on the table. When I first read this stuff as an undergraduate, I thought this was like the greatest heroic thing ever. Yes, Arya. The pithiness of her final phrase, all of her actions being so high-minded. And now I just think, oh, give people a break, Arya.
Yeah. It's very much, I'm not just acting virtuous. I expect everyone else to act virtuous.
She has really high standards for everyone. But Pliny absolutely thinks this is admirable. And we should think of it in his terms, in his cultural context, that for an elite Roman, this is absolutely presented as admirable behavior. The high watermark of a woman's virtue, of her fortitude. Right? You can't expect everyone to reach this, but Arria, she didn't just die like this, she lived like this. She lived by these principles. And then there is the point at which she knows, presumably, that Pytus has been condemned to die, but before both of them die, Pliny tells us, when her son-in-law, Thrasea, sought to dissuade her from carrying out her purpose. So this is the man who's married to her daughter, Arya, says, please don't kill yourself with your husband, and urged among his other entreaties the following argument. If I had to die, would you wish your daughter to die with me? She replied, if she had lived as long and as happily with you as I have lived with Paetus, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So again, she's saying, yes, I'd be happy for my daughter to die if you were condemned. I don't know if this conversation ever happened because this is going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Spoiler, Thrasea will be condemned to die. So I suspect there's a little bit of writing backwards here on Pliny's part or the mythologizer's part.
Maybe, although I think if I had this sort of mother and had these expectations that I would be expected to live and die by these virtues as well, I think it's the tyranny of family history at that point.
All I'm saying is, as a conversation that happened, it seems strikingly sentient of what's going to come up.
I see what you mean there.
But Thrasea will be condemned under Nero. Mm. There's no way Arya could have known that Nero was even going to come to power.
Yes.
So it does seem like a bit of, oh, this is the kind of family that does that. If Thrasea had asked her that, that's what she'd say. Mm. Again, very hard line. Be happy to see my daughter die.
Mm.
I mean, shocking.
Yeah. Yeah.
He goes on, however, Pliny, this answer increased the anxiety of her friends and she was watched with great care. So look, those around her, and this I think will seem a little more familiar to us when you think someone's in danger of suicidal ideation, you want to prevent them. And even though the Romans have this idea that this is an honorable way of dying if it comes to it, we still get friends and relatives presented as trying to prevent it.
Mm.
So there is still this idea that there are people who want this person to carry on being with them because they love them. So it's not that everyone's thinking, oh, it's so honorable, we just have to let our sister, friend, daughter, wife, whatever die.
It also shows the ideal as being extreme.
Yes. Yeah. It is a form of extremism. And that's the way it's thought of, say, with people like Cato the Younger.
Mm.
I think that he is the extreme end of this, that he's so inflexible. That yes, he can't live under a different regime. And she's so inflexible. Arya is, as she's presented, reflects the same kind of principles, the same kind of inflexible principles.
Mm.
They're watching out and trying to prevent this. However, noticing this, and this is extremism, noticing this, she said, your endeavors are in vain. You can make me die hard, but you cannot prevent me from dying. As she spoke, she jumped from her chair and dashed her head with great force against the wall of the chamber and fell to the ground. When she came to herself again, she said, I told you that I should find a difficult way of dying if you denied me an easy one. I mean, we would regard that as somebody who was...
That's somebody who needs help.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
The self-harm here is just extreme.
Mm.
Extreme is the only word I can think of for it. Pliny, however... As I've kind of already indicated it, but this is how he continues straight on from that. This is towards the end of his letter. Do not sentences like these seem to you more noble than the Paetus it does not hurt to which they gradually led up? Yet, while that saying is famous all over the world, the others are unknown. But they confirm what I said at the outset, that the noblest words and deeds are not always the most famous.
Yeah, I mean... Can't help but think that Pliny's missing the point.
No, but that is the point for him. We kind of have to accept that that's the context he's presenting them in.
Mm.
Maybe there would be some people who would think, you know, in ancient Rome, who'd think the running against the wall was...
Extreme.
The actions of somebody who was mentally unhinged.
Yes, somebody who was in trouble and suffering.
Yeah. We do also have... Dio gives us a little bit of extra information. And of course, he's writing in a quite different context. And so he has a slight different take on it. Okay, so this is in book 60, Dio Cassius, chapter 16. It was at this time that Galaesus, a freedman of Camillus, upon being brought from the Senate, indulged in great freedom of speech generally and made one remark in particular that is worth reporting. Narcissus had taken the floor, he's a freedman of Claudius, and said to him, what would you have done, Galaesus, if Camillus had become emperor? Camillus, by the way, is the first name of Scribonianus.
Okay.
So he's saying, what if the governor of Dalmatia had succeeded?
Yes, yes.
Galaesus replied, I would have stood behind him and kept my mouth shut.
Yep, good answer.
Yeah, so That's what most of us would do. But of course, that's the answer of a lowly freedman. Mm-hmm. That's what Dio's saying. These freedmen scum, what do they know? So he became famous for this remark, as did Arria for another. This woman, who was the wife of Caecina Paetus, refused to live after he had been put to death, although being on very intimate terms with Messalina, she might have occupied a position of some honour. So there's extra information about Arria.
So she had an out if she was still alive.
Yeah, so she's friends with Claudius's wife.
Mm.
Moreover, when her husband displayed cowardice, so a bit more extreme in Pliny would never be so gauche as to say that about Paetus. Dio's a long time later and isn't friends with Arria's granddaughter. When her husband displayed cowardice, she strengthened his resolution, for she took the sword and wounded herself and then handed it to him, saying, "See, Paetus, I feel no pain." Comes up slightly different from the Greek. These two persons then were accorded praise, for by reason of the long succession of woes, matters had now come to such a pass that excellence no longer meant anything else than dying nobly.
Excellence no longer meant anything else than dying nobly.
So Dio has a different take on this, and I think it's less, oh, this is, you know, great fortitude on the part of Arria. I think what he's saying is it's not about, and I think Tacitus might agree with this too, it's not about what you can get done in your life. You know, you might live under a difficult emperor. Can you make compromises? Can you get things passed? Can you make things better? But if you can die nobly, that's it.
Yeah, that's the exact opposite of what Pliny was saying though.
Yeah. Yeah. Dying nobly is a great thing to praise.
But also how you lived your life. Interesting. So that's the context for Arria the Elder, but of course they don't exist in a vacuum. And these kind of virtues and expectations are carried forward in the family. And then we've got the story of what's happened to Arria the Younger.
Yes. So remember that the reason Pliny's writing about this is that he knows the daughter of Arria the Younger, who is called Fannia. I might just mention here that Arria the Younger being called Arria is unusual. We would expect her to be called Caecina after her father, Caecina, feminine form, the adjectival form of her dad's name.
But you do get every now and then that if the mother's family is more important, then you retain that name.
Well, Joanne Shelton theorizes that it's not impossible that she was called Caecina and that they added the name Arria because her mother was so...
Ah, okay.
It's a theory. We don't know.
Well, look, you know, if Arria the Elder is this determined, then maybe she had the say on who the daughter gets saved after.
Maybe that's right. And look, I would say that these rules are not always absolutely 100% obeyed, especially by this period. And of course, the granddaughter, Arria the Younger's daughter, is called Fannia. That has nothing to do with her own father's name. And even the great Sir Ronald Syme, God classicist.
Yes, shout out.
Expressed a lack of ability to know why she's called Fannia.
Yes.
He says, who knows? It's nothing to do with either family. It just seems to have come from nowhere. So he kind of held out up his hands in despair at that. So there's something weird going on about the naming conventions that have changed in this family.
All right.
Anyway, to get back to Arria the Younger.
Arria the Younger.
Joanne Shelton thinks she's born around 24 CE. Hard to know, but just based on when Arria the Elder dies and when she seems to be married. She is, of course, the daughter of Arria the Elder and Caecina Paetus. She marries a man called Publius Clodius Thrasea Paetus. Names again.
Mm-hmm.
Did he really have the name Paetus before he married Arria the Younger? Did he add that one on later? Because it's very confusing him being called Paetus as well. She's called Arria as well, married to a man with the name Paetus in his name, the same as both of her parents.
It could be related.
Yeah, the four names makes you think that it's an addition.
Okay.
He is also somebody who wants the return of a republic.
Yeah, well, it goes in the family, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not surprising that, you know, the daughter of those two marries someone with these kind of convictions. One of the reasons the idea of the Stoic resistance gets in here is that he wrote a biography of Cato the Younger, who definitely was a Stoic, lived very much by those principles and died by them too, as we've mentioned. Despite the fact that he claims to want the return of the Republic, his career really flourishes very early in Nero's reign. He is Suffect consul in 56, that's 2 years after Nero comes to power. Pliny elsewhere, he calls him Mitissimus, a very gentle man. There's some theories that that is kind of to balance out, you know, the way that he lives his life, which is ends up being in opposition to the current regime. Mm. He's never actively identified as a Stoic. But both Suetonius and Dio say that there are tensions between Thrasea and Nero. Nero sees him as too serious. He compares him to a schoolmaster. At some point, Thrasea stops coming to the Senate. He just tries to disengage. But that, of course, is a kind of public way of kind of asserting that.
Displeasure, just quiet quitting.
Yeah, exactly. And no one gets away with that. You know, Seneca doesn't get away with that in the end with Nero.
Mm.
Dio, I quite like this quote. It's from Dio. It's from a long time later. But Dio quotes him as saying, Nero can kill me, but he cannot harm me.
Mm.
So, you know, I'm above all that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, this is a family who's sort of fun to read about their pithy sayings, but I wouldn't want to go to a Christmas party with them.
No, they sound terrible.
Anyway, inevitably, in 66 CE, the year after the Pisonian conspiracy, Nero is feeling very paranoid. He's had to put to death or demand the deaths of both Seneca and Lucan. Arria's family are quite close to both Seneca and Lucan.
Mm.
Thrasea is found guilty of treason and ordered to kill himself. He's an elite Roman. This is the norm. Now, what we hear is that, and this is actually from Tacitus, Arria wanted to die with him, Arria the Younger, but she was dissuaded for the sake of their daughter, Fannia.
Okay.
This is not something that Pliny tells us, but Tacitus, right at the end of, or close to the end of the annals as we have it, breaks off.
Okay.
Just after the death of, or kind of in the middle of the death of Thrasea. Tacitus, Annals 16, chapter 34, says, Arria, who aspired to follow her husband's ending and the precedent set by her mother and namesake, however, he advised her to keep her life and not deprive the child of their union of her one support.
Mm.
So this is a slightly different, now it's coming from Tacitus. It's a slightly different point of view, isn't it? I mean, the same could have been said to Arria the Elder. Do you want your daughter to be motherless?
Yeah. The word that I really hate there is precedent.
Yeah.
What a terrible precedent to set, and think that that's a precedent worth observing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're right that at least in the way it's come down to us, it's looking like this is what you aspire to in this family. Absolute devotion to a principle, to your husband, and that you will not put up with the regime that orders your husband's death.
Mm.
You will go along with him out of affection and duty.
But she didn't.
She didn't.
She didn't.
Now, this might be a kind of, oh, Arria the Elder has been deified so much, we have to say the daughter would want to do this too. I do wonder, as I mentioned before, whether this isn't the origin of what Pliny saying that Thrasea said to Arria the Elder, would you want your daughter to do the same? And Arria the Elder said, yes.
Yeah.
Pliny must already know that Arria the Younger didn't do it.
Mm.
It's a very dramatic point for which it's not intended on Tacitus's part for the annals to break off at that point. So we've just had the death of Seneca. Then we get the death of Thrasea. And
then he purposely lost the rest of the books. I'm curious then about Fannia having this family history, having a tendency to think about duty and death and suicide in this kind of way. Is this a family curse for her at this point? How does this kind of thing carry forward in her life?
You got to wonder, don't you? I mean, if you believe Pliny, it seems to be what she dines out on, because he writes letters about her telling these stories to him.
Mm.
And I think for Pliny the Younger, the connection to this family gives him a bit of kudos. He's got all the networks, so he does that a lot. You know, even writing those letters to Tacitus is a bit of a boon for him. But also, it gives him a chance to talk about how he survived these regimes. Not Claudius is early for him, but Nero and Domitian, especially Domitian. He did well under Domitian. That this kind of gives him a chance to associate himself with those who opposed tyrants in some way. And so he writes about Fannia quite a lot. He has another letter in Book 7, Letter 19, where he says he's really worried about her. She's unwell. And he talks about the wonderful things she has done. But it's much more about her generosity, about her as a compassionate person. She nursed Junia, one of the Vestal virgins, back to health, becoming sick herself without complaining. She cannot shake off the fever. Her cough is growing worse. She is terribly emaciated and subject to great exhaustion. It grieves me to think of so excellent a woman being torn from all of us, who will never, I fear, see her like again. So her virtues are much more in line with typical characteristics we associate with good women in ancient Rome from the elite male perspective, right? That she is self-sacrificing in a different kind of way. It's less dramatic. Nevertheless, she is nursing. I mean, you could leave that stuff up to the lower orders.
Yes.
But yep. She's nursing someone who, of course, is from a very elite background herself as a Vestal.
To the point where it makes her sick.
Yes. Mm. She's given up her own health. Then he also, and this is a bit more dramatic, twice she followed her husband into exile, and she was herself banished the third time on her husband's account. Now, her husband is a man called Helvidius, and she asks a writer called Herennius Senecio to write a biography of him. When he's brought to trial for it, she doesn't deny it and admits to providing the material. So one of the reasons I think this is worth mentioning is it's part of that whole it's dangerous to write biographies of certain people who mm-hmm. have opposed emperors.
Yeah.
And it's also the origin of that kind of idea of Stoic opposition, which I don't think we should put too much store in, but that's where it comes from. It's the kind of thing that Tacitus is writing about at the beginning of his Life of Agricola. He says, I can write this now. And what he means by now is when Domitian's dead.
Yes, I've got the freedom.
I couldn't write it under Domitian. He would have been jealous and he would have punished me for it.
Yes, or I would have had to self-censor in order to keep safe.
Yeah. And he mentions these biographers here. He mentions the biographers of Helvidius and Thrasea, so Fannia's dad, who were both charged with capital offences. Tacitus talks about them at the beginning of Agricola chapter 2 as the reasons you couldn't write biography. We have read that the works of praise produced by Arulenus Rusticus on Paetus Thrasea and by Herennius Senecio on Priscus Helvidius, so this is Fannia's husband, were made capital crimes. So it's not the acts of the people themselves, but the people writing about them.
Mm.
That not only their persons, but their very books were objects of rage, and that the triumvirs were commissioned to burn in the forum those works of splendid genius.
Right, so they were censored. Pliny the Younger does write about this, saying how it affected Fannia. She admitted that she provided the material for it. When all the copies are destroyed, she smuggles them into exile with her. Not a word did she utter to show that she shrank from the perils which threatened her.
Indeed, so she's brave as well. She's brave in a slightly different context. She's not offering to kill herself, but she's putting herself in danger in a tyrannical regime. He kind of ends by talking about how wonderful Fannia is. Again, what a delightful and charming woman she is, commanding not only deep respect, but love, as but few women can. Will there ever be another whom we can point to as a pattern to our wives? Oh, God, she's an example to our wives. I bet they love that. Or another from whom even we men may take a lesson in personal courage. Even we men.
Yeah.
Imagine a woman being an example.
All right.
One who inspires us when we see and hear with her with the admiration we feel for the heroines of history about whom we read. He's seeing a woman as an example, which is great, but he's quite surprised she can be an example. On the other hand, he's really worried she's going to die. So there is also that. This is a friend of his,
yeah.
And she's so sick. He's very worried about her. He has to draw a moral from it, though, and he has to draw that she is kind of standing there as this model for women around him, who I imagine don't thank him or her for that.
I don't like the qualities that are being upheld, that self-sacrifice and the Stoic nature of this. These women are identified contemporarily, I think, with having Stoic ideals.
It's not made explicit,
yeah.
But we can see an alignment. And Thrasea's biography of Cato the Younger, I think there's a definite link there.
There's also, in later times, we would see this as religious piety and sacrifice. This is pure martyr material, you know, making yourself sick by taking care of a priestess. I'm not sure how I feel about this at all. Not only what I feel about their actions and how they live their life, but the fact that Pliny and Romans idolized this kind of behavior
It's interesting that you bring up the later Christian tradition, because there are women who are idolized and indeed made saints because of their self-sacrifice. You know, they, in some cases, they starve themselves to death. There are stories of women kind of refusing to marry, wanting to technically marry themselves to Christ instead, and kind of that abnegation of their own bodies, which can be much more extreme in some of those early Christian tales. So I think you could potentially see these women as models for some of those later Christian women who are acting in a different context and a different set of beliefs, but they're carrying over some of that moral framework, perhaps. I mean, you could see it if you're going to kind of turn this over again as these women take charge of their lives in a way that might not have been available to a lot of women in ancient Rome. They make decisions about what they're going to do with themselves, with their lives, with their bodies. But yeah, it is hard to get past the inflexible attitudes and the way that they judge other, especially Arria the Elder, is represented as judging other people and other women for not being as good as she is. It's hard to see her as likable. But when I was 18, I loved her.
Yeah. I think the only thing that saves it for me is the fact that, and Pliny does acknowledge this, that this is so unusual.
Mm-hmm.
This is the highest bar to act like this way, to the extent where they're still talking about it 60 years later.
Mm-hmm. It is seen as this very, well, certainly the death scene, It Does Not Hurt Paetus, has been reproduced visually multiple times. There are so many paintings of Arria with the wound in her chest and the sword or dagger, it sometimes is in her hand, handing it to her husband. And it's always called, you know, Paetus, it doesn't hurt.
Yes.
And a slightly later, well, much later one, there's a Ruth Rendell novel. Her detective is Inspector Wexford, An Unkindness of Ravens. This is a slight spoiler, but it came out in 1985, where there's a group called Arria, which refers to a group of militant feminists known as the Action for Radical Reform of Intersexual Attitudes. I don't think intersexual meant the same in 1985.
It probably wouldn't mean the same to Pliny either.
No, and I think from memory, a man is killed and they're suspected because they want to harm men in some way.
Mm.
I think there's an Inspector Morse where the name Arria is important as a pseudonym as well. But I couldn't find it. So if anyone out there knows the Inspector Morse episode, I think, though, that especially the Ruth Rendell novel captures that idea that for young women, and maybe this is a 20th, 21st century, that extremity is quite appealing, that kind of firmness of belief.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I know it's a cliche, but that, and I think it was true, certainly true for me, that it's very easy to have I don't think I was an extremist, but to have very firm beliefs and principles when you're young before life has got very even more complicated and you have to start seeing that compromise might be necessary in life. So I think that's why Rendell portrays these young women as particularly interested in using her as their acronym.
Mm. And that uncompromising thing is something that comes out in Pliny, I guess, as well.
Yes, yeah. But it's very much venerated in this context. But part of that veneration, remember, is this historical situation where many people, mostly men, have had to die for their principles because we've had successive civil wars and then we've had successive tyrannical emperors.
Mm.
And so many people, especially of the senatorial class in the imperial period, had to decide whether they just give way or they stand up for a different way of being.
And Arria is a woman who willingly did that.
Yeah. For a woman's name to survive, we've covered so many situations where we don't know the woman's name, unless they happen to be married to an emperor, that it's kind of a triumph that her story survives to be commemorated from ancient Rome.
That was Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe or give us a review and tell your friends about it. You can find us on your friendly neighbourhood podcatching platform like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. We are on social media. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook. You can also follow us on Blue Sky. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast.
This podcast has been produced at the Bundoora campus of La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.